The talk contains material on Wittgenstein that I actually worked on 3 or 4 years ago and then set aside until relatively recently. And when I returned to it, it was with an eye towards connecting it with a project in ethics that's preoccupied me for a while. And I'm going to start the talk by sketching this project really, really briefly. So here's the sketch. Ethics is concerned with moral thought, and a survey of recent conversations in ethics reveals the existence of extensive agreement about where to find such thought. Moral philosophers generally agree in assuming that the moral work of language is the prerogative of moral concepts, where these are understood as concepts that are specifically in the business of articulating our moral outlook. Further, despite lacking a clear consensus about which of our concepts are the moral ones, moral philosophers generally agree in assuming that moral thought invariably comes in the form of moral judgments, where these are understood as judgments that apply some moral concept or other. One clear sign of agreement on these matters is the widespread, if also mostly tacit, acceptance of a view of ethics on which is taken to be distinguished by a preoccupation with moral judgments, or alternately, with judgments that make up one particular region of language and specify one particular practical or theoretical subject matter. This familiar view of ethics is the central critical target of the research project that's engaged me recently. I've wanted to argue that moral thinking is not restricted to moral judgment making, and further, that a stretch of thought that does not make use of moral concepts and that is not concerned with moral topics might nevertheless play the kind of role in expressing or elaborating our moral outlook that establishes it as genuine moral thought. My goal in this talk is to suggest that Wittgenstein is rightly seen as an ally for this project. And I should admit at the outset, it sounds funny to give that prologue and then to say, I don't entirely earn the right to this suggestion in this talk. And I'm happy to have that be the first question if someone wants to ask me how to sort of complete the connection. So I honestly will try my best if someone does that to me. I'm going to be particularly interested in remarks in which Wittgenstein invites us to think of the ethical, not in connection with judgments in one particular region of language, but rather in connection with the dimension of all of language. And if I have time, I'm going to respect our 40-minute limit. If I have time, I'll also say something about remarks in which he invites us to think of the interest and difficulty of philosophy as he practices it in ethical terms. Wittgenstein makes many of the remarks that interest me in the midst of, and often at least apparently as a sort of commentary on, his philosophical investigations of other seemingly non-ethical topics. It appears to follow that if we're to appreciate the force of the remarks, we should consider them not in isolation, but together with some of the philosophical preoccupations that, as it seems, first occasioned them. Taking my cue from this observation, I'm going to adopt as my initial focus not those passages in Wittgenstein's writings that it seems most natural to describe as raising ethical questions, but rather things Wittgenstein, and I mean almost exclusively the later Wittgenstein, says about meaning. I'm going to critically examine a prevalent interpretation of Wittgenstein's later view of meaning that has taken conversations about Wittgenstein and ethics in an unhelpful direction. And I'm then going to return to questions of ethics via what I regard as a more faithful interpretation. And since uncertainty is often seen as providing a good model both for the prevalent interpretation of Wittgenstein's view of meaning that I hope to oppose, and also for the claims about Wittgenstein and ethics that I hope to discredit, I'm going to take this text as my example throughout. So, the prevalent interpretation of Wittgenstein's view of meaning from which I want to distance myself is likely to be relatively familiar here, I'm assuming, so I'm going to sketch it with relative haste. At issue is an interpretation on which Wittgenstein's characteristic emphasis of the use we make of expressions is taken to show the following two things. First, that he repudiates a classical theory of meaning on which our use of particular expressions is in some sense a consequence of the meanings the expressions already possess. And second, that he exchanges this kind of classical theory for what gets called a use theory of meaning, a theory on which our manner of using expressions in some sense constitutes their meanings. Here Wittgenstein appears to be pointing out that it follows from the thought internal to a use theory that the public practices to which an expression is tied fix its meaning, that those practices determine what kinds of things can and what kinds of things cannot coherently be said with the expression. The result is a familiar image of Wittgenstein as maintaining that investigations of how we use expressions establish the bounds of sense by revealing regularities or rules in accordance with which linguistic acts must be performed in order to be fully intelligible. Now I'm going to move again with relative haste from this interpretation of Wittgenstein's view of meaning to a prevalent interpretation of his ethical concerns. Some of the philosophical interest excited by the image of Wittgenstein as championing a use theory of meaning has to do with how this kind of theory gets taken to undercut the possibility of critical scrutiny of our linguistic practices. The theory can be developed so that it represents the meanings of terms for even our most basic epistemic or critical concepts as fixed by linguistic conventions. Thus extended, the theory represents our linguistic practices as immune to what might be thought of as external forms of criticism, forms that endeavor to round on our linguistic practices and supply them with rational foundations. Very roughly, the problem is that, insofar as these forms of criticism are intended to question even received critical practices, a demand to employ critical locutions in irregular and hence also unsuitable circumstances appears to be internal to their aspirations. The result is that the very nature of such critical efforts seems to force us into a peculiar type of unintelligibility. We seem to be knocking up against a limit imposed by the structure of language, one that we would have to transgress if, per impossibile, we were to show that our linguistic practices are or are not rationally defensible. Now our linguistic practices seem to be immune to rational criticism or inviolable. I call interpretations that proceed along these lines inviolability interpretations. And one thing that interests me about these interpretations is that they're often extended so that they seem to support some form of cultural or ethical relativism. What suggests the extension is the thought that in developing what's alleged to be a use theory of meaning, Wittgenstein leaves room for the possibility of communities of speakers who have both very different linguistic practices and, by the same token, also very different critical standards. The idea is that when we encounter members of such communities, we're not justified in regarding the distances that separate us as disagreements subject to rational resolution. In addition to being unable to critically survey our own linguistic practices, we're unable to demonstrate that our practices are rationally superior or inferior to those of others. Our hopes for convergence must accordingly be vested, not in techniques of reason, but in efforts to effect conversions using non-rational methods. Without regard to whether they're taken to underwrite this form of relativism, inviolability interpretations are the common denominator of most discussions about Wittgenstein and ethics. These discussions, which date back to the first reception of Wittgenstein's later thought, often take the form of debates about the consequences of the allegedly Wittgensteinian view that our ways of thinking and speaking are inviolable. And more specifically, they often take the form of debates about whether this view has politically conservative or politically radical consequences. It is, however, no part of the project of this talk to enter further into the details of this dispute about the implications of the allegedly Wittgensteinian view that our linguistic practices are inviolable. Instead, I want to challenge the assumption responsible for whatever appearance of pertinence the dispute possesses, that Wittgenstein sympathizes with such a view. Although passages in which Wittgenstein refers questions about meaning to a study of our public linguistic techniques may at first, I don't think this is implausible, but I don't think it's the final story, may at first seem to provide support for the sort of use theory of meaning distinctive of inviolability interpretations, Wittgenstein, in fact, has no interest in and is directly hostile to the tenets of such a theory. So, setting aside these larger issues, let me turn to uncertainty. I think we can justly say that a tendency to think that Wittgenstein is committed to some version of an inviolability view is especially marked in connection with uncertainty. Some of the most widely received accounts of uncertainty's preoccupations ascribe to its author a use theory of meaning, and also suggest that the larger project for which he employs this theory is arguing that our linguistic practices are immune to rational scrutiny. So in this respect, uncertainty represents a particularly good test case for me. What lies in the background of Wittgenstein's remarks here is, famously, a couple of G.E. Moore's attempts to formulate a refutation of skepticism about the external world, about the existence of the external world. Moore's most notorious procedure, which is the centerpiece of his proof of the external world, involved placing himself in an epistemically ideal position for observing some standard object, such as his own hand or a tree, and coming out with sentences like, I know this is a hand, or I know that is a tree. Let's see a tree. A second procedure, the crux of a defense of common sense, began with a listing of sentences Moore took to express unquestionably true or commonsensical empirical propositions. For instance, here are two of Moore's examples. My body has always been either in contact with or not far from the surface of the earth, or the earth had existed for many years before my body was born. In this second procedure, Moore again attempts to show that we can arrive at instances of knowledge by prefixing no to each sentence. And now Wittgenstein's remarks in uncertainty start from objections to both Moorean procedures, objections he frequently summarizes by charging that the types of utterances that preoccupy Moore, and that he includes the skeptic as well, are meaningless or nonsense. This charge is most often construed as a direct expression of a use theory of meaning. Moreover, it seems undeniable that there are remarks in uncertainty that, at least taken in isolation, can plausibly be represented as supporting such a construal. In this text, as elsewhere, Wittgenstein is clearly concerned to emphasize the importance within philosophical investigations of the meanings of particular expressions, of attending to how the pertinent expressions are used. He also clearly traces what he sees as Moore's and the skeptic's lapses into nonsense to a failure to attend properly to uses of I know. And he tries to address this failure by describing circumstances in which we ordinarily advance claims to know. What are in question are, Wittgenstein tells us, circumstances in which there's room for doubt, in which error is intelligible, in which there's a question of saying something informative, and you could actually go on, but I won't. At first glance, these different textual observations may seem to support the conclusion that Wittgenstein's criticism of Moore is appropriately spelled out in terms of a use theory of meaning. The familiar suggestion is that Wittgenstein thinks Moore cannot intelligibly assert the kind of thing he wants to say he knows, because it's impossible to advance a claim to know that kind of thing in the circumstances in which we ordinarily advance claims to know. To the extent that it's thus spelled out in terms of a use theory, Wittgenstein's charge of nonsense appears to depend for its force on the identification of some sort of misfit between, to use Wittgenstein's German, the Sätze to which Moore wants to prefix I know, and the circumstances in which we ordinarily advance knowledge claims. Sätze can be used to mean either sentences or merely grammatical entities, or propositions, entities that are as such in the business of expressing thoughts. So it's important to note that in order to capture the nature of the alleged misfit, we need to understand Wittgenstein's remarks about Moore's Sätze as remarks about propositions and not about sentences. For it's only in virtue of our grasp of the nature of the propositions or judgments allegedly in question that we're supposed to be able to recognize that we're no longer dealing with circumstances in which we ordinarily claim to know things. So as it gets analyzed here, Wittgenstein's charge of nonsense appears to amount to the charge that Moore slides into unintelligibility when he tries to assert his knowledge of certain independently proposition expressing or independently meaningful combinations of words. If it's right to represent Wittgenstein's critique of Moore as thus grounded in the use theory of meaning, this is what I just pointed out, it must be the case that the many remarks in which he discusses the Sätze to which Moore prefixes I know are properly understood as remarks not about sentences, but about propositions. And at this point, it might appear that we encounter powerful evidence of ascribing a use theory to the author of Uncertainty. For while it's clear that with Wittgenstein, I'm going to start that sentence again, while it's clear that Wittgenstein is critical of Moore's anti-skeptical procedures, it's no less clear that his critical engagement is at bottom driven by a measure of real admiration. What Wittgenstein takes Moore's defense of common sense to contain an important insight. What Wittgenstein finds compelling is Moore's idea that certain empirical judgments play a special role in our modes of thought and speech. In Uncertainty, Wittgenstein returns again and again to different expressions of this idea. He talks about empirical propositions, Erfahrungssätze, and judgments, Urteile, which stand fast for us, or which are like the axis around which a body rotates. He compares the role certain empirical propositions play in our language to the stable but not permanent channels in a riverbed. And he tells us that these propositions are like hinges on which our various questions, doubts, and investigations turn. Insofar as these passages seem to support an understanding of remarks in which Wittgenstein talks about the Sätze, to which Moore prefixes I know, as remarks about a special set of empirical propositions, they may be taken to speak for attributing a use theory of meaning to Wittgenstein. Further, insofar as they're taken to speak for attributing such a theory to Wittgenstein, they may be taken to speak directly for reading all of Uncertainty along inviolability lines. The pertinent passages represent some empirical judgments as fundamental for our linguistic practices. So to the extent that Wittgenstein is taken to be arguing, in accordance with the use theory, that it's impossible to question, doubt, investigate, advance knowledge claims about, etc., certain judgment, and to the extent that he's also taken to be referring to precisely these judgments, he appears to hold the view that there's a significant respect in which our linguistic practices are immune to rational scrutiny. This gives us a rough sketch of the sort of inviolability interpretation that gets traced out within some of the most influential accounts of Uncertainty. Let me add that some readers go on from inviolability interpretations to attribute to the author of Uncertainty various forms of cultural and ethical relativism. The passages from Uncertainty that typically get accented in this connection contain descriptions of encounters between people with very different worldviews. Thus, to mention some central remarks, we're asked to envision ourselves confronted with people who consult oracles instead of physics, and also with people who believe human beings sometimes go to the moon. I forgot to remind myself to mention the date at which this text was composed, but that's obviously relevant to the author of Uncertainty's choice of that particular example. But we're asked to imagine the idea of people who believe that human beings sometimes go to the moon. Sorry, I'm not good at telling jokes or getting that to come out, but I hope you get the idea. And we're invited to imagine Moore disputing with a king who's brought up to believe that the world started with him. And in his commentary on these encounters, Wittgenstein tells us that although we may convert others to our way of thinking, it will be a conversion of a special kind. And he adds that in contrast to what we may be inclined to assume, we're sometimes forced to pin our hopes for cross-cultural understanding, not on reasons or proofs, but on methods designed to shape our own or others' responses, that is, on what he calls, three times in Uncertainty, he calls methods of persuasion. Now, I want to emphasize that it's not written into these remarks that they express a relativistic outlook. The remarks only seem to express such an outlook, given the assumption that the persuasive methods Wittgenstein mentions here are properly understood as non-rational modes of communication. This assumption, in turn, seems reasonable if we take it for granted that Wittgenstein is maintaining, in accordance with an inviolability interpretation, that framework judgments are immune to rational assessment. And if we take it for granted further that he's suggesting that different linguistic communities may have different sets of such judgments. Against this background, it seems natural to suppose that what Wittgenstein is doing in his remarks on cross-cultural encounters is developing a relativistic creed on which it's impossible to overcome divergences between members of different linguistic communities by rational means, and on which we should therefore place our hopes for convergence in the application of merely persuasive, non-rational methods. But since an inviolability approach is built into the background that makes this supposition seem natural, it follows that there's a sense in which an account of Wittgenstein as a relativist stands or falls with such an approach. And this brings me to my next topic. According to an inviolability approach, when Wittgenstein speaks of nonsense in connection with Moore's utterances of I know that such and such, he's identifying a problem, not with what such and such expresses, but rather with Moore's efforts to assert that. He's complaining that there's no way for Moore to get his claim to know the particular judgments in question to dovetail with the circumstances in which we ordinarily say we know things. It's possible to get a sense of the limitations of this interpretative approach, and also to begin to develop a more satisfactory alternative in the following manner. And I want to mention here, acknowledge that the main elements of the alternative approach to uncertainty that I'm about to describe are described in the 1998 paper of Jim Conant's. When Wittgenstein declares that Moore-type utterances are nonsense, he's not suggesting that the utterances involve judgments such that no claim to know them can be squared with the conditions of knowledge. He's suggesting instead that it's not clear what judgments are at issue at all. For instance, he occasionally glosses his references to Moore's Setze as references to his words. This is a couple, three or four passages in Uncertainty. And in doing so, he invites us to greet his interest in these Setze as interest, not in items that already possess a determinate logical character, but in items that can only be characterized in grammatical terms. He thus expresses sympathy for the view that until we understand what intelligible act of speech Moore is performing with his sentences, we're not yet in a position to say what those sentences mean. Wittgenstein's attitude is, in these respects, consistent with things he himself says in both early and later writings about the limits of sense. Wittgenstein repeatedly says things to the effect that logic is internal to or constitutive of thought, and that there's therefore no such thing as recognizing something both as thought and as lacking logical structure. He develops this view by attacking the idea that a combination of signs or an utterance might fail to make sense because of what it, in virtue of what we might confusedly slide into thinking of as its illogical logic, tries but fails to convey. A great deal can be said about different ways in which this idea gets developed in Wittgenstein's early and later writings. And although I can't do justice to this topic here, I'm going to return to it in connection with Wittgenstein's later writings in just a moment. But right now, I simply want to suggest that the inviolability analysis of Wittgenstein's criticism of Moore is unsatisfactory because it encodes the idea. According to the analysis, Wittgenstein is supposed to be assuming that Moore's utterances of, I know that such and such, are nonsense, and also that it's nevertheless possible to identify the meanings of the sentences to which Moore prefixes I know, at least well enough to inquire whether they can be made to fit with I know. The upshot is that Wittgenstein appears to be describing the discovery of logical misfits between the meanings of Moore's sentences and the context in which he produces them, or, in other words, that he appears to be claiming that Moore's utterances are unintelligible on account of the particular, at least barely intelligible, things that they try unsuccessfully to say. Consider the analysis of Wittgenstein's criticism of Moore suggested by an interpretation of uncertainty which, in contrast to inviolability interpretations, takes into consideration this view of Wittgenstein's view of the limits of sense. On this alternative interpretation, Wittgenstein appears to be claiming that there's no such thing as a clash between sentence meaning and circumstances that results in the expression of a senseless sense. So we should expect that when Wittgenstein describes Moore's utterances of I know that such and such as nonsense, his point is not that there's something discordant or ill-fitting about what we might be inclined to think of as the sense Moore's words do have. His point is rather that we reject Moore's words because here they lack any clear meaning at all. Notice that this analysis is directly at odds with tenets of inviolability interpretations, since Wittgenstein isn't suggesting that any judgments are at play in Moore's anti-skeptical practice. It follows that he isn't suggesting that there are some judgments that are immune to criticism. Now we have in front of us a basic description of the approach to uncertainty that I find superior to inviolability interpretations. Although I think this new approach is on the mark, I also think it needs to demonstrate its ability to overcome an exegetical hurdle that might get captured in the following set of questions. Here are my questions. Isn't it too hasty at this point to conclude that inviolability of interpretations of uncertainty are bankrupt? What about Wittgenstein's claim that some judgments stand fast for us? Doesn't the fact that Wittgenstein associates such judgments with Moore's anti-skeptical maneuvers show that he thinks certain very basic judgments figure in those maneuvers? And with all due respect for observations about Wittgenstein's remarks on the limits of sense, doesn't this fact speak for an understanding of Wittgenstein as claiming that certain very basic judgments are inviolable? Despite whatever initial plausibility it possesses, the protest traced out in this series of questions can't be sustained. Wittgenstein's remarks about judgment standing fast for us don't speak for an inviolability interpretation. In making them, Wittgenstein is not claiming that certain judgments lie beyond the reach of critical assessment. Rather, he's discussing ramifications of a view of judgment that is the conceptual counterpart of his view of the limits of sense. If we help ourselves to an understanding of judgment as a move in a language game, we can formulate the later Wittgenstein's view of the limits of sense in terms of the idea of the priority of judgment. Wittgenstein rejects the assumption that we can somehow identify the logical character of expressions or features of speech situations outside the context of complete judgments. After all, this assumption is consistent with the possibility that some utterances are nonsense because they employ expressions in contexts with which they are supposedly incompatible. And the mark of Wittgenstein's view just is the thought that there is, at best, the appearance of a possibility here. So to endorse the later Wittgenstein's view of the limits of sense is to suggest that if we want to identify the logical character of expressions or features of speech situations, we need to start with complete judgments and ask what logical contribution the pertinent expressions or features make to the judgments in question. Now, one of the later Wittgenstein strategies for defending the idea that judgments are logically privileged in this sense involves attacking pictures of language acquisition on which we originally learn how to judge by appealing to the guidance of prior logical categories or rules. Wittgenstein repeatedly observes that learning to judge is ultimately a matter of nothing more than cottoning onto or developing a sense for what different judgments have in common. He attempts to show that as learners, we're called upon to manifest an appreciation of which of the similarities among judgments presented to us are important. In one section of Uncertainty, he expresses his view this way. This is Uncertainty 140. We do not learn the practice of making empirical judgments by learning rules. We are taught judgments and their connections with other judgments. A totality of judgments is made plausible to us. In another section, Wittgenstein sums up his view of judgments with these words. This is 124 of Uncertainty. We use judgments as principles of judgment. This view of judgment forms the backdrop against which Wittgenstein talks about some judgments standing fast for us. Since according to this view, I'm quoting 149 now, since according to this view, our judgments themselves characterize what it is to judge, it follows that in order to recognize an utterance as a judgment, we need to incorporate it into the pattern of things we recognize as judgments. This leaves room for the possibility of situations in which, although it at first appears that a person is judging very differently, we fail to locate her utterance or inscription within a nexus of judgments, and as a result, fail to recognize her as judging at all. The author of Uncertainty repeatedly describes cases in which, although we may be inclined to respond to a person's words by saying that she is wildly mistaken, it would, he thinks, be more correct to speak, not of a mistaken judgment, but of something more like a mental disturbance. And one of his examples, there's something like, I think, 15 in the text. One of his examples is a case in which a man comes out with, I'm a woman. One of the suggestions Wittgenstein is making here is that in these cases, there's no smooth or natural connection between the new utterance or inscription we encounter and judgments we already recognize. Another suggestion is that our experience of not being able to make sense of a new utterance or inscription reveals our reliance on certain other judgments that, at least for the time being, don't come into question for us. This is what he has in mind when he claims that we discover the judgments that stand fast for us. So although there is, as I mentioned earlier, a a sense in which Wittgenstein credits more with the insight that some empirical judgments play a special role in our language. There's also a sense in which he charges more with betraying his own insight. In the part of his work in question here, Moore is attempting to refute skepticism about the external world by first listing sentences that, as Moore sees it, express commonsensical judgments, and then prefixing "I know" to them. Moore is really clear about recognizing that his verbal performances are irregular, but he doesn't think he needs to worry about their relationship to ordinary verbal performances. Wittgenstein, in contrast, thinks Moore needs to worry. Wittgenstein holds that there's no such thing as recognizing something as a judgment in a manner that doesn't draw on our sense of how it fits into a larger pattern of judgments we already make. When he speaks in a manner of suggestive of indebtedness to Moore, of certain empirical judgments playing a special role in our language, it's precisely in reference to the idea of such a pattern. It follows that from Wittgenstein's perspective, Moore's anti-skeptical procedures are unfaithful to the very insight on which they're founded. What Wittgenstein wishes to get us to see is that when Moore produces his utterances of "I know that such and such," there's not enough continuity with what stands fast for us to recognize the utterances as even improper assertions of knowledge, and hence not enough continuity for us to recognize them as involving judgments at all. So at this point, it seems clear both that Wittgenstein's rejoinder to Moore doesn't take the form of an argument to the effect that certain special judgments are inviolable, and also that Wittgenstein is therefore not an inviolability theorist. And in addition, it also seems clear that Wittgenstein is not a relativist. Wittgenstein only appears to be a relativist if his remarks about how certain cultural gulfs need to be bridged by persuasive methods are construed as remarks about how certain such gulfs can only be bridged by non-rational means. And Wittgenstein's view of judgment, or alternately his view of language, speaks directly against this construal of his remarks. It makes it easier to explain this last point, I think, anyway, if you characterize Wittgenstein's view in terms of a philosophically irregular pragmatic emphasis. If we take pragmatics to be concerned with those aspects of linguistic expressions that are functions of their use, and if we take semantics to be concerned with those aspects of the relation between linguistic expressions in the world that determine truth and falsity, then we can say that a philosophically regular view or idea is that we should recognize the significance of pragmatics while at the same time treating it as at best an addendum or accessory to semantics. This observation makes it possible to say that what's distinctive about Wittgenstein's view of language is that it directly opposes this idea. It is distinctive of Wittgenstein's view that propensities and sensitivities that we acquire in learning to use expressions, and that are traditionally treated as of merely pragmatic interest, make necessary contributions to all our linguistic capacities, including those that semantic theory aspires to illuminate. This is significant because, to the extent that the view asks us to conceive even our best efforts to understand how things are as essentially presupposing certain propensities and sensitivities, it leaves room for the possibility that modes of discourse that are persuasive in the sense of aiming to elicit various propensities and sensitivities may, as such, directly contribute to fully legitimate truth-oriented understanding. It follows from this conclusion that by Wittgenstein's lights, there's no good reason to insist that persuasive modes of discourse are as such incapable of serving as a point of genuinely rational contact between people with very different cultural backgrounds. And since Wittgenstein only appears to be a relativist, if his remarks about persuasive methods are construed as remarks about non-rational methods, it also follows that there's no good reason to insist that he is a relativist. So a careful study of uncertainty reveals that Wittgenstein is neither an inviolability theorist nor a relativist. And if we want to be able to talk about Wittgenstein in ethics, we clearly need a fresh start. And I have something like 5 minutes. And so I will cut up part of it, but I'll give you a sense of where I'm going. One thing that's important at this point is to acknowledge, I think it's important to acknowledge, that there are in fact a number of projects in ethics that are inspired by Wittgenstein's thought, and that are aptly described as taking their bearings from the philosophically irregular pragmatic view of language that I just discussed in reference to uncertainty. I don't mean that these projects are actually presented in terms of a pragmatic view of language, but that in effect that's what they are. The centerpiece of the projects I have in mind is an intuitively appealing, realist account of moral judgment. These projects aim to show that the kind of pragmatic view of language that Wittgenstein favors equips us to improve on classic cognitivist accounts of moral judgment. And more specifically, they aim to show that this kind of pragmatic view equips us to improve on classic cognitivist accounts of moral judgment by allowing us to take at face value our ordinary understanding of moral judgments as essentially a matter of sensitivity to how things are, without thereby forfeiting our ordinary understanding of such judgments as intrinsically practical. I know that was terribly cryptic. I just had to say it. That's what I think they're doing, and I can't explain it further right now. Anyway, I think John McDowell presents us with the most influential and insightful project of this kind. And in this context, I think it's appropriate also to mention David Wiggins and Sabina Lovibond. I myself am a fan of this body of work, and I take it to be important, but I'm not going to say anything more about it. And this is because I'm inclined to think that we fail to register what's distinctive about the reorientation in ethics that Wittgenstein is urging if we limit ourselves to a focus on moral judgment. This will be the sort of last thought, I think, of this talk. Here it's helpful to bear in mind that throughout his later opus, Wittgenstein represents what I just called his pragmatic view of language as one in which mastery of a natural language is inseparable from a complete practical orientation or form of life. This reflection equips us to appreciate the point of some central themes of Wittgenstein's remarks on ethical topics, and by the same token to appreciate a sense in which some of these remarks stand opposed to an exclusive focus on moral judgments. One recurring theme of these remarks is that ethics is in some sense a condition of the very possibility of contentful thought, or, in Wittgenstein's words, that ethics is transcendental. Wittgenstein develops this theme by inviting us to regard the practical orientation that he sees as internal and essential to the mastery of a natural language as at the same time an ethical one. He claims that all thought imposes a demand for an active or spontaneous contribution, and is therefore something one cannot help but do for oneself. No one can think a thought for me, he writes in one passage, in the way that no one can don my hat for me. Further, he also claims that thinking for oneself involves relying on and perhaps refining one's sense of salience and significance, and in this respect requires some sort of self-mastery. No one can speak the truth, he writes in another passage, if he is still not mastered himself. In these and other passages, Wittgenstein moves from a view of linguistic competence as intrinsically practical to the idea that we can't help but pay for all of our thoughts with a certain ethical effort. And he thus suggests that all of language is characterized by a certain ethical dimension. And this is the moment in Wittgenstein's thought that's of greatest interest to me here. It's the moment at which he can most clearly be seen as rejecting a view of ethics of the sort that dominates recent research in ethics, and which its concerns are limited to judgments in one particular region of language. And I'm not going to go on any further. I do think that there are remarks in which Wittgenstein describes his own philosophical practice in ethical terms that are sort of directly related to the remarks I just touched on. But I think it's 40 minutes. Thank you.